Hi, I'm your host, Iora, and this is Broccoli Book Club, a socially progressive podcast aimed at analysing timely and thought-provoking reads. And this episode is the author interview, which follows the Broccoli Book Club episode on What Have I Done? And today, I'm excited to be joined by its author, Laura Dockrell, an award-winning children's author, illustrator, and performance poet based in London. Laura has a highly successful series of books following the journey of the mischievous 10-year-old, Darcy Burdock. And in 2014, this series was shortlisted for the Waterstones Children's Book Prize. Laura regularly performs at festivals like Glastonbury, Hay, Edinburgh, and the London Literary Festival. Her memoir, What Have I Done, documents the experience, the pain, and recovery of her postpartum psychosis. This episode contains conversations about mental health. Listener discretion is advised. As with most things, we met through Zoom. I was in my bedroom and Laura was in her partner Hugo's music studio. Throughout the call, you might hear a baby in the background, and that's Jet, the tiny human at the centre of Laura's world. Our conversation was a small window into Laura's busy life as a parent.
Well, playgroup, I think that's what's
triggered it.
I just woke up and I sound like Cher in Do You Believe After Love. So just for your listeners who are thinking, what on earth's going on here? I was hit with a rare and debilitating mental illness postpartum after having my baby called postpartum psychosis. And when Jet was 3 weeks old, I was hospitalised in a psychiatric unit. I've never before experienced mental health issues before that. And I had just gone through the trauma of physically giving birth too. So this was a lot of big changes for me. When Jet became 6 months, I decided to write a blog about this experience on an Instagram account called Mother of All Lists by Clemmy Telford. Partly because I knew things were sort of flying around and circulating that I had got unwell and I wanted to speak for myself what I was experiencing. Partly because people have, again, a very kind of sensationalised version of what somebody with postnatal depression looks like. That's a kind of woman clawing the walls in a white nightie, where's my baby? Maybe a baby killer, which also is just not true. And I wanted to dismantle that. Also because I wanted to offer conversation, help. I was so lucky that I had support and friendship around me to get me through. And in the area where I work, in the arts, I feel we're so fortunate that we can go there and talk about this. Lots of women that I've met since aren't as able to do that. They have to kind of put their office clothes on and get back to the desk and put on a brave face. And also because I put up a picture of myself smiling when I had a baby holding a glass of champagne, like, guess what, world, I'm a mum. When inside I was suffering extreme suicidal thoughts, intrusive thoughts, anxiety. I was a mess, basically, a boiling hot mess. And I was like, I've got to speak up for this. And writing that, I thought would alleviate me and get it off my chest. Actually, it did the opposite. And I got so scared of getting unwell again, I decided to go back on my medication. I didn't want to go out. I just found like it felt like everybody knew, you know, and everyone was watching me. My paranoia kind of increased, suspiciousness increased, insomnia increased. And I just thought, what actually do I do? I don't have any options here. We got approached by lots of people wanting to turn it into a book, obviously, because of my children's books. I almost felt like I was making a deal with the devil, you know, like, oh, okay. That voice we're talking about was going, oh, what are you going to do now? Go on Strictly Come Dancing for postpartum psychosis. What are you going to do? Go on I'm a Celebrity, come out of here for losing the plot. I don't think so. And then I was like, oh, I can't actually do this. I can't, as I said before, I can't let my illness infect my lovely rose-tinted world of children's books and La La Land, not realising that actually writing about it was about to save my life. And it started writing itself. I turned down the book deal, I went back, I turned down it again, and eventually made friends with an amazing editor called Rowan Yap, who was just said, look, just send me the chapters when you do them. And that's just what I started doing. I wrote it all on my phone whilst Jet was asleep on me. Whenever I could snatch a minute, I would, which is why most of the chapters are quite short. But I quite liked that in the end anyway, sending them across. And once they were sent, I never had to look at them ever again. And then about 6 months later, I went to my publishers and they were like, are you ready to meet it? And I was like, okay. The copy that you're reading is about 85,000 words. It was 275,000 words. It was this big, all written on my phone, all never read back. So this is very different to the usual way that I write, which is reading, checking. And now my phone, I can't even type the word spaghetti without my phone being like, schizophrenia?
Oh my God.
That's amazing.
Wow. Honestly. That is amazing. That should be, you know, if in this podcast, that should be the thing that we intro with.
Oh, totally. And you know what? It's so healthy because all of these things, what drives everything, right? Everything which is uncomfortable is fear. That's what's driving everything. If you see it as science, you see these words used to absolutely, why are they even in my dictionary, the word suicide? You know, now I go to write, you know, soup. Suicide? No, I'm just trying to say soup. But it's normalised it for me now and means my friends have normalised it. We can talk about it. And now my friends can speak to me properly. I can be present for them rather than be like, ooh, that's odd, you know, don't talk to me about it. That's too heavy. Or go, cheer up, love. No, that doesn't happen with me. It has enriched me so much more.
What did you edit out of the book? So obviously 2/3 of it was gone.
Yes. What did I edit out? Some characters, trails of thought. So like a bigger bit on fear. And also I had a lot of strange dreams when I was pregnant that I all sort of in my psychosis believed were connected up to my psychosis, were trying to tell me things or show me things. And obviously, insomnia was such a great part as well of my illness at the beginning and recovery. So we cut all the dreams, but the dreams were a really difficult thing for us to cut, but they were just so long. And also just having to be very mindful that these are real people. Though to me, this is my story and I've got free license to an agency to do what I want with it. I just had to trim back on how kind of open I was being on everybody. And at the end, giving a lot of unsolicited advice to people giving me unsolicited advice, which my publisher was like, that feels like maybe a mum book, you know, save that for this. I was like, oh yeah. I hate mummy bloggers, but also I'm being a mummy blogger by hating mummy bloggers. This is very mummy blogger squared. To be honest with you, my closest family can't even read it. My sister hasn't even read it. Hugo hasn't even finished it. My mum can't read it. And I think that's because the nature is so close. You know, this was very painful for all of them. This was the first big thing that happened in our lives. It was a traumatic explosion for all of us involved. We're only seeing this world from our own eyes, right? So it's like, how do you especially, and then you've got the psychotic world, so everyone's going, that didn't actually even happen. So you've got to be very, very careful and get your permission. Yeah,
exactly.
I think once everyone had seen how my recovery just, if it was a graph, I went from like this kind of middle level to just such improvement once the book began coming together and happening and I was dealing with all these big things. And also so much of my insomnia, for example, was due to the fact that I was trying to work out what had happened. So putting it all to bed in that way, filing it all, I sleep great now. Like filing it all like that was just such a weight off my shoulders. I think my family were all like, oh, okay. Like the proof is in the pudding. Like she is, I don't really know what the proof is in the pudding actually really means, do you?
Neither do I.
The proof is in the pudding. My point is that my everyone around me seeing me write this, seeing how much my recovery sped up from writing this. I mean, it's actually been proven scientifically that the more active you are with your recovery, helping others, talking about it, trying to get better, actually has less chance of relapse. I can only vouch for that. You know, that's the biggest thing that I want to encourage. If anyone comes to me who's experienced an illness like mine or similar, who says, I'm thinking of writing about it, if your circumstances are good at home and you've got a good support network, I would say go for it. Because being able to also fictionalize it, read it over and over again once it's done and have that distance, it actually helps you see it as a story now in the past.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. 2 episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
I'd love to know, Laura, did you read a lot as a child?
I did, actually, but I think there's always a kind of misconception as a author that you must be best friends with Stephen Fry and David Attenborough and know every word in the dictionary. And I was a big reader, but I'm like bacteria and I want to live in the life of everything, whether that be fashion or food or TV. And I'm not ashamed to say that I get just as much inspiration, you know, from watching a trashy TV program, reading a children's book, eating a really good bowl of pasta, or being nosy in the supermarket. All of them count. And actually, I think being a writer isn't just about reading, it's also about living.
So I'd love to know your journey to being a published author. How did that come about, you know, when did you start writing seriously?
So reading all the time, but also writing all the time, and the writing was a big deal for me. So I always had a notebook by my bed and would always be scribbling, drawing, just keeping journals without even really realising I was doing it. I've got a younger brother and sister, so kind of basically producing them into theatre shows without them really even knowing they were doing it from a very small age. That was kind of my existence. That was all I really knew. And I got to that academic point where I met the big ugly red pen that was always circling, you know, my spelling, my grammar, which did knock my confidence a little bit. And in English, I would struggle because I would always do well in the creative. But, you know, when it came to the academic side of English or theatre, that's where I would fall away. Practical, I was always fine. So then what I started doing was actually learning my work off by heart and performing it. And that's how I actually got published. I was really lucky. I had the right person in the right crowd that had seen me at a festival and just transcribed what I was reading out loud onto the page. And my first book, Mistakes in the Background, came out mid-2000s, I think 2008 now. It literally was the case of like a guy on a bike coming to pick up the pages each evening, and then they just like scanned it all and turned it into a book. And then I was like, wow, I'm actually a published author now. But I guess we're kind of taught of these ways, you know, that you have to do it, this kind of, you don't really realise there's ways you can creep through the cracks, you know, you can do this your own way. And that's why it's so exciting. Lockdown is going to be very exciting to see how new talent emerges, because art always emerges, it always breaks through like weeds. It's going to come and it's going to be really juicy. But also social media is creating all these new ways of people being able to express themselves, so it's a really exciting time.
And now I have my favourite question. I'd love to know, what are the three books that have shaped your life?
This is a really hard question. And, you know, the reading that I have done since going through the experience I had of being unwell are the books I wished I had read before I got unwell, but they wouldn't have made the most amount of sense. So it's a real catch-22. So I kind of feel like I have a before my illness selection of books and an after my illness. Does that make sense? You kind of only really learn what you've been through once you've been through it. I mean, this is what life is about, right? When you're, once your head has cracked, you're like, oh, this is what old people are talking about when they say life is hard. They're not talking about redundancy and bills. They're talking about this shit, which actually transforms you. So I guess what made me want to do what I do for my job, which was writing children's books, probably was, I was thinking of a book called Meeting Midnight. My nana bought for me when I was really small, still in primary school, which was my first kind of poetry book by Carol Ann Duffy. And that really kickstarted my love of poetry. I remember once being in a bookshop and deliberately pulling my tooth out earlier than what it should have come out, purely because I knew my dad was the secret tooth fairy and would exchange the tooth for a book. All the kids in my school liked poems, but when the kind of rhyming poetry left, I was still there clinging on, enjoying it. That's what showed me that. Also, I really could see how illustration and poetry could marry up, words and pictures endorsed each other, and that happened with that book. Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak, a picture book which taught me that a kind of picture book can be anything and you can put your own reflection, doesn't have to spell it out for you. Jane and Peter are going to the shop. Oh, boring. I like to know that you can, you know, from literally in front of you, a bowl of soup, just lift off, rocket ship your brain to somewhere else and you're in a world of monsters. That book, hardly any words, maybe 500 words, and you're completely transported to a new world and you can put your own emotional experience, and the artwork is incredible. And then The Story of Tracy Beaker by Jacqueline Wilson, which taught me of a little girl whose life wasn't perfect, but her way of looking at the world. I'd never really met a female lead that was just ouchy and grumpy and shouty and expressing herself so articulately and messily, and she's flawed and loving. And that's what made me think, I really want to write for children for my job. I think I can do this. But now I literally just drink up memoirs. I love reading and they help me. It's so cliche. And after I got ill, I didn't want to go near books. I didn't really write for a while because I was like, I don't want this experience to bleed into my real life. Like, I don't want this to be a part of my story. Not realizing that was actually hindering my recovery. If you push it away, you resent it. And actually it's about going, no, this is a part of what happened to me. I bring it in closer. Actually now, when my book came out, I felt like I was walking down the aisle with my illness. I was like getting married to it. I was like, yeah, okay, forever now, me and you. And that's helped me so much.
Sorry to interrupt, but like, go on. Isn't that actually the whole point, as you said, of recovery? Knowing that it's never really going to leave. It's always going to be there. And you have to make peace with that. And sometimes it does creep up in the darker times or the more unstable times. But you make that sort of peace with it, thinking, yeah, it's always going to be there, but you know what? We have to get on now. It's like that annoying sibling, you know, you have to get on.
Totally. And you know what? So it should. So it should creep up, because usually it's a warning for you going, this situation is a little bit hot for me, or a little bit cold. I'm not quite cool here. Like, what is going on? And it's uncomfortable. It's really unpleasant. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But when it first happened, I would kick and scream, you know, mentally, emotionally, why did this have to happen to me? I've got a newborn to look after and I can't even put my shoes on. I don't know myself anymore. I can't look at myself in the mirror to, okay, how am I going to learn to live with you? To them being like, you and me, girlfriend, look what we got ourselves through. And when people go like this, it's not you, it's the illness. I'm like, no, it is me. Of course it's me.
Yeah.
Who else is it? Of course it's me. It's not healthy, that teaching, because it makes people push that part away from them, which actually, yes, scientifically causes you to turn all your adrenaline systems on, to lock your body, to be, you know, to see this as a threat, which actually is going to reduce you of feeling any less anxious. So get on with it in the best, nicest possible way. Actually embrace the unpleasantness, because it is you. It is you.
Exactly. Or what are you reading, or what do you read for guilty pleasure? Or what do you do for guilty pleasure?
Okay. So, well, it's not really guilty, because I love food so much. I'm trying to eat more plant-based, be a vegan. Well, I'm doing my very best. So experimenting with food. I'm a sucker for cooking shows. Any cooking show, I'm all over it. Salt, anything to do with salt.
So is that the guilt?
Probably the guilty pleasure is probably the salt, which I'm allowed to feel guilty about. But you know what? Guilt is so important. I ain't got time for guilt. Guilt is like not on my radar one bit. People will know, your listeners will know of mum guilt, dad guilt, parent guilt, which is constant. You're guilty for going to work, guilty for not going to work. You can't win. So as soon as I went by guilt, I thought it was going to take ages to lift, but it just doesn't. I hear my mouth sometimes. It's not your fault, for example. Perfectly left on time, the bus makes you late. I feel my mouth going, and I just won't say it. I'm like, don't say it. Just stand there. Just hold it. You didn't make the bus late. It's not your fault. Watch, you'll start helping. So actually, no guilty pleasures, just pleasures, babes. Pure pleasure.
What an amazing
pure upfront
answer.
Pleasure.
I love that so much. If there's someone dead or alive that you'd love to have dinner with, who would that be?
Who would that be? Probably Kate Bush. She's alive. I saw her show at Hammersmith Apollo, and it was the most incredible show I've ever seen. I know she suffers herself, but her son, well, this is the story that I've heard, encouraged her to come back to do these few shows at Hammersmith. When I say tree trunks fall from the sky and burst through grand pianos, a helicopter goes over your head, she drowns in the... It's the most immersive piece of theatre, music I've ever seen. And it just totally blew my mind of what a show could look like. I don't even know if she probably earned anything out of it, because so much money went into the making of it. You could see the vulnerability in her eyes, and she is somebody that is, you know, adored, famed, celebrated for all the right reasons, but this was just so generous and giving of her. And that's just something I guess I'm really interested in, is the relationship between the art and the real life. Where does it start and stop? When do we show and share this with our audience? How much responsibility do we feel because these people by what we do, do we have to then show and share everything with them? But also, I'm just a great fan. You know when you just feel like someone gets it?
I love that. I love that. Lastly, I just want to know, are you working on any projects at present that you'd like to share with your readers?
Project Raising a Little Person, and very excited to announce to book club listeners that I am about to do a podcast with Broccoli called Zombie Mum for more real chat. That's going to be real talk on parenthood, not just from mums, from dads too, not just from parents, also from children who have experienced parents' struggle through the change of having a baby, bringing a new life into this world in all its wild and wonder, but probably off on lots of tangents about mental health. Good and bad, light and shade.
Talking to Laura felt like catching up with an old friend. She's so open, vulnerable, candid, and really chatty, which is exactly what I thought she'd be like after reading her book. And luckily for us, Laura will be continuing this open conversation on her brand new podcast, Zombie Mum, where she'll be addressing all of the unspoken challenges of parenthood and mental health. I want to say a huge thanks to Laura for coming on today's show. And thank you for listening to Broccoli Book Club. Next month, we're reading The Good Immigrant, edited by Nikesh Shukla. Remember, you can read along with us, make suggestions, send in your thoughts via voice note to voicenotes@broccolicontent.com. In the meantime, follow us on social media. Our handle is broccolicontent on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Goodreads. I've been your host, Diora, and you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at The Diora. Broccoli Book Club is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castbox, Pocket Casts, and all your favourite apps. This podcast is produced by Jarja Mohammed, executive produced by Tony Phillips, and our sound engineer is Ben Williams. This is a Broccoli production.